This is Sam Darmacena, and you're listening to CJRU 1280 AM. This story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative.
There are all these myriad ways in which a failure to address the healthcare needs of folks that are imprisoned can lead to adverse effects for broader community health. And this is what we've been saying throughout the pandemic as well, is that the health of prisoners during COVID-19 is a matter of public health. Prisons don't live in a vacuum, or they don't exist in a vacuum. And as much as we might try to push them to the margins of our popular imagination, people go into and out of prisons and jails all the time, whether that's folks that have been incarcerated or whether that's correctional staff. And so a failure to address chronic outbreaks like we're seeing right now is going to impact our ability to get something like COVID-19 under control in the broader public as well.
That's Jessica Evans, professor at Ryerson University's Department of Sociology. She's also a member and co-founder of the Toronto Prisoners Rights Project. We talk about the relationship between prison health and public health. In our conversation, we discuss the common misconception that healthcare in Ontario prisons is delivered by the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care, when in reality, it's the responsibility of the Ministry of the Solicitor General. And we talk about what this provision of healthcare means within the context of a pandemic. To start off, Jessica tells me about how her academic and community work aims to shed more light on prisons, prison expansion, and prisoner rights in Canada.
So I'm interested in how under capitalism, prisons function to produce and reproduce a particular type of population. And that population is very much tied to the needs and requirements for labor at a particular point in time. And in a space like Canada, which is a settler colony, that kind of need for population and this idea of who Canadians are is also always contoured by race and racism.
Jessica has two research projects on the go, which we discuss later in this segment, and she tells me that much of her community work with Toronto Prisoners Rights Project greatly informs her research. If you're not familiar with Toronto Prisoners Rights Project, it's a community-based advocacy organization. The spirit of this work is to support prisoners and draw attention to the harms caused by incarceration.
So during the pandemic, what we saw, for example, during the early months of the pandemic is that a lot of Ontario facilities released prisoners. And, you know, a lot of prisoners right now in Ontario facilities have not actually been convicted of a crime. So these were easy things to do. But they were being released into a world that had been utterly shut down, where there was no access to social supports, where housing was in short supply. So we started raising funds for folks during the pandemic, also to support people inside who didn't have access to adequate supplies of soap and other forms of personal protective equipment. To date, I think we've raised about $150,000, maybe a little bit more, and most of that's been distributed to prisoners and former prisoners.
In the last year or so, the Toronto Prisoners' Rights Project has been running public awareness campaigns on prison strikes and much more.
In the last year, there's been over 6 prisoner strikes, whether those are hunger or labor strikes in Ontario. And so we are regularly in contact with folks inside. We communicate their messages to everyone on the outside. Other things that we've done, we've run a public webinar series, Contain COVID-19, Not People. We ran this in the early phase of the pandemic. It was intended to draw attention to the various angles of incarceration and incarcerated populations, and particularly their experiences under the pandemic.
Throughout our conversation, you'll hear Jessica use the term prisoner as opposed to inmate, which is often used in government communications. She tells me that prisoner is a political move by activists to draw attention to the violence of incarceration. Inmate, in comparison, neutralizes that violence. The term inmate can also be used by a number of other people living in congregate or state-run facilities, where the objective is treatment. Examples include long-term care homes and psychiatric institutions. She adds that while recognizing those spaces rarely provide treatment or care either, it is important to be clear that prisoners are not provided with treatment even at a superficial level. If you aren't familiar, Canada has federal and provincial prisons with distinct populations.
In the federal system, which is administered by Correctional Services Canada, you have individuals who have been sentenced to 2 years plus a day. So broadly speaking, in the federal system, you're dealing with people with fairly long sentences or much longer sentences. The provincial system is, again, the system of corrections that is administered provincially or territorially. The body in charge will depend on the particular province. So in Ontario, it's the Ministry of the Solicitor General. In Manitoba, it's the Department of Justice, and so on and so forth. But it's generally the department or the ministry responsible for safety, corrections, those kinds of things. In the provincial system is where you're going to find people that have been sentenced to 2 years less a day, or, and more likely, it's individuals who are awaiting trial and awaiting sentencing. So as I discussed, most of the provincial population is being held on remand. So they have not been sentenced or convicted of a crime. But you do have people in the provincial system that are serving a sentence. It's a shorter sentence, so less than 2 years.
Before getting into the state of healthcare in Ontario prisons, Jessica debunks some common myths around prisoners and the prison system.
When you say prison or when you say prisoner, I think because of popular kind of media narratives and also kind of political fear-mongering and the use of prisons and prisoners to drum up support through tough on crime policies and those kinds of things. When we think of prisons and prisoners, we are often kind of drawn immediately to this imagery of violent offenders. And, you know, violent offenders make up a very small portion of our prison population. In Ontario, if you look at the jail system, about 70%, perhaps a little bit more right now, perhaps a little bit less because of pandemic releases, but around 70% of our incarcerated population in the provincial system in Ontario, they're there on remand. So they've not been convicted of a crime. They've not been sentenced for a crime. So immediately, and this is true across Canada, the numbers will vary based on the province a little bit, but anywhere between 50 and 80% of the provincial jail population is there on remand. They are awaiting trial. And they can spend a lot of time inside on remand. So some people, even though it's intended to be short term, because of backlogs in the court system and any number of issues that arise administratively, people end up in that system for years.
She also challenges the notion that systems of punishment keep us safe.
How are we going to create a world in which violence is unlikely to occur or less appealing by responding to instances of violence with more violence? That just doesn't really strike me as an effective strategy. And so when I talk to people about prisons and incarceration as a prison abolitionist, these are some of the pieces that often come up. Oh, what about violent offenders? And, you know, oh, well, we can't, you know, we can't ignore violence in our society. And I just simply think that these are kind of mythologized approaches to justice in our world. What else is a big myth? I mean, I think the other piece is that prisons and prison systems and systems of punishment somehow keep us safe. And that, again, is something that I would really like to push back against.
To start off our discussion around prison health, Jessica breaks down the healthcare provision and needs at federal prisons. She tells me that the Corrections and Conditional Releases Act of 1992 is the piece of legislation that provides for health in the federal system. Broadly speaking, it establishes that Correctional Services Canada, CSC, must provide prisoners with essential healthcare and reasonable access to non-essential healthcare.
And of course, that's left fairly broad for interpretation. And it's expected that that healthcare will be at the standards that are considered acceptable in the general public. So these are the kinds of guidelines for the provision of federal healthcare. And generally what happens is Correctional Services Canada will establish contracts with regulated and non-regulated healthcare professionals who then operate within what are often referred to as primary healthcare centers at the institution itself. CSC will also contract out to and engage with kind of community-based relationships and partnerships with providers in the community when the services required could not be effectively provided for on site. So here we're thinking of like advanced diagnostics, if you need an MRI, CAT scan, those kinds of things, as well as if you need emergency services.
Research shows that prison populations tend to have complex health issues, but Jessica adds that when prison populations are grouped by the length of their sentence, there are patterns in their healthcare needs as well.
In the federal system, we are dealing with people that are serving long sentences and sometimes life sentences. And so one of the more prominent issues that we see in federal corrections is dealing with an aging population. And of course, there's a lot of particular healthcare needs that accompany an aging population. So things to think about here are accessibility. I mean, prisons are not built to be accessible. And what happens if you need assistance with mobility? For folks that are aging considerably or perhaps experiencing dementia or Alzheimer's, you know, assisted living is something that becomes necessary. But of course, that's not something that the prison is kind of constructed to provide. End of life care, again, something that is really difficult to access in the system. And while Correctional Services Canada does try to link people with end of life or to end of life and palliative care, it requires a lot of negotiation and communication between correctional services and the parole board. And oftentimes that kind of stuff gets mired in administrative backlogs. And so you have people that are in significant need of care, but aren't able to access it because of all of these administrative barriers.
Jessica notes that one in every five prisoners in federal are over the age of 50. And this is important to consider within the context of COVID-19 as well.
There's this thing called prison age. And all that means is that your physiological age when you're incarcerated is usually about 10 years older than your biological age. So that's the result of a combination of things. So one is obviously, we know that people that present in the system often do have complex health needs to begin with. So they're already in poor health, not all of them, but many. And this is, you know, often due to systemic and structural issues around poverty, racism, classism, all those kinds of pieces. So people may present with poor health when they first enter corrections, but of course, corrections itself is a disabling institution, and it is an institution that creates a lot of illness and a lot of chronic issues. So when we speak of an aging population in federal corrections, one in five people are over the physiological age of 60. And this is why, you know, issues around vaccination have become so pronounced in federal corrections. You are dealing with a vulnerable and aging population.
And looking provincially, healthcare in Ontario prisons is provided and administered by the Ministry of the Solicitor General.
So we have a situation in which about half of the country's provincial institutions, healthcare is provided by the provincial healthcare body. In the other half of provinces or territories in Canada, the healthcare for prisoners is provided by the correctional body. In Ontario, that's the case. In Ontario, healthcare for prisoners is provided and administered by the Ministry of the Solicitor General, not the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care. So BC, Alberta, Nova Scotia, Quebec, Newfoundland and Labrador and New Brunswick, those are all spaces in which healthcare is provided by the provincial healthcare body. Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, PEI, Nunavut, Yukon and Northwest Territories, we see healthcare being provided by the correctional or justice ministry or department.
And just like the federal prison population, prisoners in the provincial system have common healthcare needs too.
In the provincial system, you have a fairly transient population, right? So you have people serving shorter sentences, so 2 years less a day, as well as a lot of people on remand. So you have people moving in and out of provincial corrections much more rapidly. And unfortunately, what we see, because, you know, as I would argue, a lot of so-called kind of corrections interactions are underpinned by systemic and structural inequality, you see some of the same people coming in and going out and coming in and going out. And so this presents particular challenges, right? Especially if the body responsible for providing healthcare is corrections. And then when you're out in public, it's the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care. And let's say you have someone who's presenting with healthcare needs. There's very little continuity of care between those two spaces, right? So if someone's in provincial corrections and you start treating a particular issue, once they're out and released back into the public, they're not able to access those same resources. So they have to start over again.
Jessica adds that this lack of continuity of care can be especially concerning when it comes to infectious disease or harm reduction.
All of these pieces become more difficult to address. I mean, first of all, in a prison at all, but secondly, in a system in which healthcare provision is just so divided and decentralized.
Knowing that prison populations have complex healthcare needs in general and now hearing that there are more patterns connected to short and long-term sentences, I asked Jessica if having a distinct healthcare system for prisoners could be helpful. She tells me that it's possible, but not in the way it's being done in Ontario right now.
I don't have a firm answer. I mean, my firm answer is that people shouldn't be incarcerated. Okay, so putting that aside, I think, you know, what we've seen with provincially provided healthcare, having healthcare specialists and bodies that are explicitly tasked with the provision of healthcare, provide healthcare for prisoners, that is the best option. And so something that happens in a system where healthcare is provided by correctional authorities is, of course, that healthcare is one of many, many things that they are responsible for. And that means that the Ministry of the Solicitor General, for example, they have a list of, you know, maybe 5 points that falls under the Ministry of the Solicitor General's correctional mandate. And healthcare isn't actually even mentioned, but the well-being and safety of prisoners is. And that can be interpreted quite widely, right? What the safety means of prisoners might not be interpreted as healthcare.
In our conversation, Jessica references a study published in August 2020 titled Quality of Antenatal Care for Women Who Experience Imprisonment in Ontario, Canada. Also, just a note that antenatal care is another term for prenatal care.
There was a recent study by doctors at obstetric doctors at McMaster University, and they found that only 48% of incarcerated pregnant women received 8 or more prenatal visits compared to 85% of the general population. And they found that of those 48% of incarcerated women who received adequate prenatal visits, only 38% of them received any visit at all during their first trimester. So the vast majority of pregnant women in corrections don't receive an obstetric appointment in the first trimester of their pregnancy. And again, this is often because there's not adequate staff to accompany them to their appointments, or it's too costly to do so. So in these situations, the imperatives of health and the health of prisoners, these are being balanced against monetary issues. They're being balanced against security issues, all these kinds of things. And this isn't to say that this might not happen in a system where, you know, the healthcare body, the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care, is responsible for this, but it certainly seems less likely, right? Or many of these issues could be improved upon, because again, here we're dealing with a body whose exclusive mandate is to provide quality of care. And so I think at the end of the day, the proposal to have a focused system of healthcare provision for prisoners, I think, is one that makes a lot of sense. As we've been discussing, there are some very distinct healthcare needs for prisoners, but having that provided by the Ministry of the Solicitor General, Departments of Justice, and those kinds of things, I don't see that as being a viable solution.
Jessica tells me that there are rules in place to protect prisoners, like the Corrections and Conditional Releases Act mentioned earlier, plus the Nelson Mandela rules by the United Nations. International standards by the UN are non-binding, of course, but they provide a blueprint nonetheless.
And the Mandela rules state that prisoners, and I'm going to quote here, prisoners should enjoy the same standards of healthcare that are available in the community and should have access to necessary healthcare services without discrimination on the grounds of their legal status. And they should have access to these services in a way that ensures continuity of treatment and care by qualified personnel acting in full clinical independence.
Seeing as Jessica researches and organizes around prisoner rights, I asked how, even with all of this, the state of healthcare for prisoners in Ontario has ended up here. This is what she had to say.
If we look at the provincial level, there's a lot of autonomy and discretional authority that is accorded to individual superintendents. And so while the Ministry of the Solicitor General is responsible for corrections in Ontario, there's very little oversight and accountability as to what goes on in each institution. And that's because ultimately the buck tends to stop with the superintendent. So a lack of accountability and transparency, I think, is one of the big pieces. And that's certainly what, you know, folks like us at the Toronto Prisoners' Rights Project are trying to do. So we're trying to use our platform to elevate the voices of folks inside so that these things can't continue to go unnoticed, unseen, unheard. And so that's kind of a first step, I think. Now, a lot of people have, you know, there are a lot of great lawyers in the community as well who are addressing these things through class action suits and those kinds of pieces. So is it allowed? No, it's not allowed. Is it part of the punishment? It certainly feels like it. And I think, you know, there are actors in this system that probably act with intentionality and fail to care for prisoners out of a personal prejudice or malice. But I think there's also a way in which prisoners have been systematically dehumanized and kind of shoved to the extreme margins of our society, pushed out of our popular conception of the public or of the nation. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, you know, they've been evacuated from our understanding and our ideas of citizenship. And when a population has been dehumanized to that extent, you know, you don't even think about what you're doing or not doing with them. You don't think about these things. And so I think there's, you know, there's something larger that's happening beyond, you know, the few bad apples. It's that the system and the structure itself is intended to dehumanize and to erase these people from our kind of popular imagination.
Along those lines, she offers a few theoretical concepts like malign neglect and organized abandonment to make sense of the current situation.
Michael Tonry is a scholar who has developed this concept of malign neglect. And, you know, he uses the concept to think about the ways in which particular communities are abandoned in a particular way, how policy decisions, you know, serve to undermine the safety of particular communities, which then leads to their over-incarceration. But I think we can think of this concept of malign neglect within the prison as well. And certainly others have shown this. And in this case, you know, the lack of provisioning of healthcare can be understood as part of this whole process of malign neglect, right? Underserving particular communities in order to organize their exclusion from society. And that's also something that Ruth Wilson Gilmore kind of discusses when she talks about organized abandonment. And so she uses the concept organized abandonment to talk about the ways in which we systematically abandon through social policy, through spatial policy, urban planning, and all those kinds of things. We systematically abandon particular communities, and that abandonment carries through to the prison as well, especially when we consider that the majority of people that are incarcerated will at some point be back in our communities. So failing to provide services to them while they're inside is a way of continuing this cycle of organized abandonment. So conceptually, we have some ways to think about this. And certainly, you know, the line from a lot of critical folks is, yes, absolutely. Like, this basically feels like an extension of the punishment, right? By failing to provide adequate healthcare services, you are also kind of continuing this line of punishment.
To stay updated on Toronto Prisoners' Rights Project, find them on Instagram and Twitter by searching their organization name. Their website is torontoprisonersrightsproject.org. To continue learning from Jessica, keep an eye out for her ongoing research projects.
One is the SHRC Partnership Engage Grant to look at the rights of prisoners under COVID-19. So it's a partnership engage grant, which means that myself and my co-investigator, Dr. Aaron Doyle from Carleton University, we've teamed up with the Prisoner HIV/AIDS Action Support Network, otherwise known as PESAN. They're a community service provider that does a lot of harm reduction work with prisoners. So we've partnered up with them to look at how a couple of things. We want to look at, first of all, how did COVID-19 kind of protocols in Ontario prisons and jails, how did they infringe upon the rights of prisoners? So we have a lot of stories of folks not receiving showers for 3 weeks, folks not going outside for 3 weeks, people being denied access to phone calls, and also things like, you know, not being able to access programs. You know, it makes sense, and we can understand why that might be taken at kind of the interpersonal level, right? Like not having individuals in those spaces. But the complete eradication of these programs for over a year, we're coming up on a year, that has impacts on people's ability to apply for parole, for example, right? It has impacts on people's ability to effectively reintegrate when they are released. It impacts discharge planning, a whole bunch of things. So we're looking at that, kind of how the pandemic has affected prisoners' rights.
This research project will also look into the experience of service providers at prisons, healthcare providers included, amidst the pandemic. Her second research project is looking at the increasing use of public-private partnerships for building prisons in Canada.
And one of the things that comes up a lot is people say, well, at least we don't have a privatized system like the US. And to be sure, we don't have a privatized system. But we do increasingly have private and market entities entrenched in the correctional system in Canada. So at this point in time, most new pieces of correctional infrastructure that are built through public-private partnerships. And what this looks like in practice is that the government gets into a contract with a private actor to design, build, finance, and sometimes also maintain the correctional institution. And the government pays a lump sum to that private body once they've completed building the piece of infrastructure. The remainder of the contract is paid out in monthly installments over the next 30 to 40 years. And so if we think about this, you know, all of these institutions are being built. They're being built with expanded capacity. So we're expanding our capacity to incarcerate. And governments are tied into these contracts for 30 to 40 years, which effectively means that our governments are locking themselves into a policy of incarceration and at a particular level for the next 30 to 40 years.
She's also looking at the implications that this would have on things like building repairs and whether those contracts leave room for loopholes where repairs can be pushed back, because ultimately all these things would impact the lives of prisoners.
And while that might sound small, what it means in practice is that prisoners end up in unnecessary amounts of lockdown, for example, because parts of the infrastructure are broken. So if something breaks at Toronto South Detention Center, depending on what it is, it may require that prisoners are in lockdown. And that means, you know, being confined to your cell, if not all day, all but 1 hour of the day or something like that. And so there is a very real way in which the involvement of private bodies to build this infrastructure impacts the kind of infrastructure and the day-to-day life of prisoners as well.
This is Sam Dharmasena, and you've been listening to CJRU 1280 AM. This story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative, a project by the Community Radio Fund of Canada.